abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It is Wednesday, November 6th, 2013. More international stuff here for you guys today. Yesterday, we dispensed with the idea that Denmark is the world's happiest country because they have a long government maternity leave program. And before that, we dealt with the Swedish welfare state, and we've dealt with Somalia. Isn't Somalia an example of what goes wrong when Bill Clinton isn't around to help everybody? We dealt with all those things. But now today, we're going to talk about Australia. Now, why are we talking about Australia? Because I keep getting people writing to me saying, you got to respond about Australia, because my friends keep telling me, look, Australia has got a super high minimum wage, and employment is very robust there. So you see, you stupid dunderhead free market guy, there is no relationship between the level of the minimum wage and the level of employment. Oh! So I thought, well, you know, what's the Tom Woods Show here for if not to dig deeper into this stuff? Like, I thought that Denmark show yesterday was absolutely fantastic. I mean, we really got to the bottom of what was going on with that happiness research showing Denmark to be the happiest country in the world, if that means anything. And I think we came up with some good explanations talking to an economist from Denmark. So today we are going to talk to my old friend, Dr. Ben O'Neill. Ben O'Neill is a lecturer in statistics at the University of New South Wales, and he's coming to us today directly from Australia, and he's going to clear everything up for us, and it's going to be super great. So, Ben O'Neill, I'm so glad to have a chance to talk to you again. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I was appalled to learn that it's 8 o'clock in the morning as we are recording this. 8 o'clock in the morning for you, and for me, that's practically the middle of the night. I'm sorry I had to pull you out of bed to come do this, but it's a good cause, my friend.
No problem. And with preparation time, it's even worse.
So right.
I accept your apology, but it's okay.
Okay. Well, I mean, the main reason I wanted to talk to you is that, you know, in the U.S., a lot of times people who have political agendas will bring up some other country as an example of why their proposed policy won't ruin the economy. So they'll say, look, Sweden has a big welfare state and they're doing pretty well. Or Australia, in this case, look at Australia. It has this high minimum wage and its employment figures seem pretty good. So I thought, well, let me think of some sucker I know in Australia who can come talk to us about this. And I thought about you, Ben. So let's go point by point through this. First of all, let's talk about right now. I guess there's something like a 5 to 6% unemployment rate in Australia. But when you look at the figures for unemployment in the U.S., the figures are all screwy and the government's manipulating them to seem lower than they are. And when you unpack it, it's much worse than it seems. Is there anything similar going on in Australia?
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of the same things. And I can't speak comparatively about the degree to which the U.S. or Australia is worse in that respect, but certainly the same kind of fudging of figures goes on here. The ABS, our Australian Bureau of Statistics, which looks at unemployment figures, although it does calculate an unemployment rate of around 5 to 6%, it also has another measure called extended labour force underutilisation, which looks at underemployment and things like this. And the reason that they have this other figure is that within their unemployment figures, they'll count someone as employed regardless of how low a number of hours they work. So even if a person was to work 1 hour a week, they'd be classified as employed. And when you look at the underutilization figures and the more realistic labour force figures, The rate of underutilisation is a bit more than double the official unemployment rate. It's at around 14% at the moment. There's also been a lot of shifting of people away from the job seeker classification that counts in unemployment figures towards non-job seeker classifications through a big push within the welfare system to get people into education and training, and also an increase in the number of people being classified as disabled. So there are a lot of similar things in Australia going on in terms of how these figures are, I'd say, manipulated. Partly it's manipulation and partly it is just a genuine effect of efforts to put people into education and training in cases where perhaps otherwise they would be looking for work. But there's certainly the 5% to 6% figure really understates the situation a lot.
Now, how high is the minimum wage in Australia?
Sure. On the face of it, the minimum wage here is a little over $16 an hour, and that's probably the figure that gets reported a lot in the US. But it's important to understand that in Australia, that minimum wage figure applies to workers over 21 years old. And we actually have a system of graduated minimum wages for younger people. And minimum wage, you need to understand, mostly affects low-skilled workers, and therefore mostly affects young people. At the younger end of the spectrum in Australia, the minimum wage is graduated down to as low as about $6 an hour for people under 16, and then it goes up gradually with each year of age from then until it hits the adult figure that's a bit over $16 an hour. So although you probably hear the $16 figure in the US, and that is correct for people over 21, for the people where the minimum wage is actually biting a bit, I suppose, in terms of unemployment, the very young, the figure is much lower due to that graduated system.
Well, that is an important factor, because then the number of people who would be, this is a key thing when understanding the minimum wage, you have to think about the number of people who are likely to be earning a wage that low is not that great to start with, and most of those people are going to tend to be the younger people. So they've already been, in a way, accounted for here in the graduated system. Now here in the U.S. and here, I mean, basically in any country, you ask economists about the minimum wage, and the consensus is it creates unemployment. Now, in recent years, some economists have softened a bit on this. Now, is it the case, though, that if I travel to Australia, economists are going to give me a completely different view? They're going to say, well, here in Australia, somehow we've made it work.
No, I don't think you get a different view. I mean, I think to begin with, even just having that system of graduated minimum wages is itself a tacit admission by the government that they understand that the minimum wage does cause unemployment, particularly among the young, and therefore they have these lower rates for younger people in order to, I guess, reduce the extent to which that occurs. If you are talking to economists in Australia, I mean, I guess I can't give any view of the broad consensus, but I know at least in studies on the minimum wage in Australia have been undertaken, the findings have been broadly similar with elsewhere, which is that the labour demand, when there's an increase in the minimum wage, labour demand goes down and unemployment results. And that's, again, if you have a look at the scholarly literature in that area, you see that that's detectable mostly among young people. So I think that that's well understood here also. Australia isn't really some magical place where somehow the laws of economics don't apply. And I think that's reflected in the graduated minimum wage system, that the government already understands that this is an effect of their policies.
All right. Now, I guess though, I could imagine an objection running as follows, that, okay, yes, it will have some disemployment effects, but the point is that, and yes, it's true that the employment picture in Australia is not as rosy as it may look, but neither is the employment picture in the U.S. The point is that if we implemented a $16 minimum wage, assuming a dollar for dollar exchange rate, even if we had a $16 minimum wage in the U.S., sure, it would have some depressing effects, but apparently they wouldn't be catastrophic, because look at Australia.
Well, I mean, I guess it depends what you mean by catastrophic. I don't think the imposition of a minimum wage ends the universe, but it does have negative effects. I mean, if you have a look at the Australian case, what you do see is that unemployment outcomes due to the minimum wage do show up to some extent across the age ranges, but they are concentrated among that lower group. It's important to understand when you're talking about the minimum wage that the minimum wage actually only does anything in terms of A, affecting people's wages, and B, causing unemployment in situations where economists refer to it as being binding, meaning it actually has to, in order to do anything, it actually has to specify a wage which is somewhere in the vicinity of the amount of money people are earning in that area. If you were to impose a $16 minimum wage on neurosurgeons and movie stars or something like that, it would simply do nothing.
Right.
So if you were to impose a very high across-the-board minimum wage in the US, perhaps even targeted only to people over 21, similar to the Australian system, the effect would be that on high-income earners, nothing would happen. Their wages would continue as before and there would be no unemployment. But on low-skilled people, and there would be some in the older age groups, it would then price them out of a job effectively.
So how would you then summarize, I mean, is there anything else that you want to say on the general subject of the minimum wage that's unsaid up to now, or do you feel like this is more or less the case? This is the way things are over there?
Well, I think the most important thing for people that aren't that familiar with economically what the minimum wage does is just to have an understanding that all that the minimum wage laws actually do is prohibit employment contracts operating with a wage in a certain range. And in Australia, for example, it's legal to employ someone for $0 an hour, and it's legal to employ someone for $16.37 an hour or more, but it's not legal to employ them for any amount of money in between that. So all that the minimum wage does effectively, it doesn't create any new jobs, it doesn't create any new capital or new resources. All it does is prohibit certain mutually beneficial exchanges of employment. And that necessarily means that anyone who would have liked to enter into an employment contract in that wage range, perhaps because their productivity is not high enough to justify a higher wage, now cannot do that. And I think when people understand that all the minimum wage is a prohibition on working under certain circumstances, that becomes clearer. I think people sometimes have this foggy view of the minimum wage of thinking that it's a law to raise people's wages. Actually, all it is a simple prohibition. It prohibits employment contracts that operate in a certain wage range.
But I think some people have a faulty understanding of how wages rise in the first place. And I think they think that without a minimum wage, there would be employers who could just arbitrarily keep the wages low. And this is really the only way we can get unorganized and unskilled workers any type of a boost. So yeah, it's true that it is simply a prohibition. But on the other hand, these fat cats are going to need laborers, and this will force them to pay at least a little bit more to those laborers.
I do agree with you that a lot of people think that way. I suppose to those people, I would ask them if they believe that that's true and that employers can simply arbitrarily set a wage rate as low as they want, why are there any jobs that pay above the minimum wage? I mean, there are jobs, I mean, for example, my academic job pays well above the minimum wage, not even close to it, and there are people who earn an enormous amount more money than me. There are movie stars that earn millions of dollars a year. I mean, tens of millions of dollars a year. If it were true that employers can simply arbitrarily pay people as low as they want, absent the minimum wage, then those things wouldn't exist. So I suppose for people who are thinking that way, I guess I'd just urge them to have a look around at just jobs in general and ask, why is it that anyone earns more than the minimum wage, if that's the case?
Now, as long as I have you for, you know, X minutes here, and we've covered the minimum wage, I was looking up the sorts of things that you've researched and written about, and you've written about one law that is even more popular than the minimum wage, and that is the idea of anti-discrimination law. Now, everybody favors anti-discrimination law, don't they? And if not, why shouldn't they?
Well, almost everybody, I suppose. I don't favor it, and so that's what my writings have been about. I suppose I'm a statistician by trade, so this is my area of interest. And one of the things that being a statistician teaches you is that the extent to which you can use information about other people as proxy characteristics to try to infer other things about them. Excuse me. And anti-discrimination law, in large part, prevents that occurring. It creates a situation where certain kinds of logical inferences are regarded as unlawful and are attacked as being irrational, when in fact statistical inference tells us that it's often quite rational to discriminate against people on all sorts of grounds, including even the kind of verboten grounds of sex, age, race, and so on. There are instances where it's perfectly rational to discriminate on those grounds. And certainly I'm not saying that all discrimination on those grounds is rational, because it's certainly not. But there are instances where sex discrimination or age discrimination or race discrimination is rationally justified, and I think morally justified. And anti-discrimination law prevents that. For that reason, I refer to it as a system of mandatory irrationality.
All right. Well, when you make a claim like that, you're going to have to give some specifics. So give me specific examples.
Well, an example I like to use is an example from the 1980s in Washington, D.C. There was a study of taxi driver service in Washington, D.C., and essentially this study found that taxi drivers in Washington, D.C. were less likely to pick up passengers who were young black males. I can't recall the exact methodology, but assuming their findings were right, and I think it's quite plausible that they were, taxi drivers, and in fact this was both white taxi drivers and black taxi drivers, were less inclined to pick up a prospective taxi passenger if he was a young black male. And when inquiring into why this occurred, it was simply that, well, we know the crime rate among this group is higher than, say, I don't know, old Asian ladies or whoever else, any other demographic group, and therefore it's a high-risk candidate for us as a passenger. And so this was used as a kind of an example of a breach of civil rights, and as an instance where political action needed to be taken to stop these taxi companies and these taxi drivers acting in a purportedly racist manner. But when you actually have a look at the kind of logical dynamics of that situation, you have a case where a taxi driver may very well wish to judge a person by their individual merits, but they're in a situation where they simply don't have the information that they need to judge a person on their individual merits. They have, you know, maybe 5-6 seconds to make a decision of whether to pick up a person who's waving them down for a taxi fare. And they have to use whatever observable information they have in that instance to try to determine whether the passenger's high risk. Now, in that situation, statistical science tells us that sex is a very useful predictor of crime, so is race, so is age. And so it's perfectly rational for a taxi driver in that situation to discriminate against males and in favour of females. It's perfectly rational for them to discriminate against young males, in particular teens and young adults. And it's also rational for them to discriminate by race. So I think in those kinds of situations, you get a case where actually people are acting perfectly rationally and towards a quite legitimate objective of trying to avoid criminal assault, say, and they're acting in a situation of very limited information. And I don't think anti-discrimination law adequately reflects that kind of situation.
And I remember reading about this, and you're right. The black taxi drivers were just as unlikely to pick up young black males in particular neighborhoods whites were.
They're no less scared of assault than white taxi drivers are, and the inference for them is exactly the same. So it's not surprising to me that that's the case.
Well, what kind of anti-discrimination law do you have in Australia? Is it similar to what we have in the U.S.?
I believe it's similar to what you have in the U.S. We have a Commonwealth statute, or a couple of them, in fact, which prohibits discrimination on various grounds, mostly demographic grounds, sex, age, race, political opinions, pregnancy, sexual status, and so on. And in certain kinds of areas like the provision of employment or the provision of goods and services and things like this. So certainly the statutes in Australia probably would be imposed on that kind of situation involving the provision of taxi fares.
Ben, is there an easy place where people can find your writings?
Sure. I mean, probably the easiest thing would just be to Google my name, which is Ben O'Neill, you'll find my Mises Institute's author page where most of my writings are. Some other academic writings are available through my staff webpage.
I remember when you were, either I was about to go back home or you were. Maybe it was me.
I think I was over in the U.S. at the Mises Institute, and you bought me lunch, I believe.
Right, right, right. One of us was just about to leave. I think it might have been me. And
yeah.
And so I took you out for lunch. And I just wanted to know, what was libertarianism like over in, you know, like, what were the fortunes of it? How many people were involved in it over in Australia? And I remember your answer was that for whatever reason in Australia, people tend to be just middle of the road, not too excited either in either direction. And so it's hard to get people really burning with interest and excitement over a philosophy that really is very much one way. You know, individual liberty, bang, bang, bang. It just doesn't seem to fit well with the Australian temperament. Is that still the case?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, the blessing and the curse of Australia is that the people here are very easygoing, and that's very nice from a kind of cultural perspective, but it does make it difficult to get people riled up about political injustices and things like that, and that's, I suppose, just an aspect of the Australian culture and temperament. But the libertarian movement here is growing. I'm amazed now, even just in the last few years, the number of new libertarians I've met here, younger than me, who I didn't know existed. So there is definitely kind of the same exponential growth, I think, down here as what you guys have been experiencing in the U.S.
Well, I hope it continues. And Ben O'Neill, I really appreciate the time today helping to shed light on what's really going on in Australia so it can't be exploited for nefarious purposes all the way over here in the U.S. So thanks again.
Thanks very much. And I might actually try to write up some of my thoughts on this in an article and post that on the Mises Institute website if they'll have another article by me. But thanks very much, Tom.
Okay, my pleasure. Thanks again.
Cheers.
All right, that's Ben O'Neill, everybody. I appreciate his time today. Let me wrap up with a few other thoughts here. I mean, for one thing, on the minimum wage subject, we should remember, I mentioned this in our conversation, but I didn't develop it the way I originally intended to. Very few people earn the minimum wage, percentage-wise. When you look at it in terms of all the wage earners in the economy, it's in the single digits, percent, earn the minimum wage. So when the minimum wage is raised, you're already dealing with a very small percentage of the labor force. So no, you shouldn't expect wild fluctuations in unemployment just based on the minimum wage. Let's also point out, you may note a lot of times labor unions are agitating for increases in the minimum wage. And you may say to yourself, hey, well, I was thinking for a minute about talking heads there when I said you may say to yourself, but you may say, why are labor unions agitating for a higher minimum wage? People who belong to labor unions don't earn minimum wage, or it would be the crummiest union in the world. What would be the point of being in a labor union if all they could negotiate for you was a minimum wage job? So why would labor unions be so interested in increasing the minimum wage when none of their members earn the minimum wage? Now, we can believe that it's because of some kind of Marxian sympathy for laborers all over the world, and we just are showing solidarity. But, you know, it's funny. People who are inclined to believe that believe the worst when it comes to businessmen, right? Businessmen are evil. They want to poison everybody. But if it's labor unions, well, these are just wonderful. They have no interests of their own that are different from the interests of all of society. But think about it. Here's why a labor union, even though none of the members earn the minimum wage, here's why they actually want higher minimum wages. It's because low-skilled people earn the minimum wage. High-skilled people are in the union. And so if you can price low-skilled people out of the market, then people are going to be more inclined to hire the high-skilled union guy. So suppose you got a union guy who earns $20 an hour. But then you have, let's imagine that the minimum wage is $6.50. And three low-skilled workers can do the work that he can do. Well, three times $6.50 is $19.50. Save 50 cents by hiring those three. But, if the minimum wage goes up even to $7 an hour, 7 times 3 is $21, now it's cheaper to hire the high-skilled labor union guy. Could it be that the unions have their own interests going on here, and they are not simply public-spirited organizations looking out for the common good? I can't believe it. I refuse to believe what I just told you, people. Way, way too cynical. All right, a couple other quick things for you guys. One is, I've had a request, can I do transcripts of the interviews so you can just flip through them and look at them? And I am thinking about doing that. It costs a little money. I mean, it would cost me some hundreds of dollars a month to do it, and I'd prefer not to be completely out of pocket. So if there is some interest in it and you want that, maybe you could chip in $5 a month or something. We could somehow make that work. If that's something you're interested in, can you just let me know, like on Twitter or somewhere? I don't know. Email me through tomwoods.com or something. If that's something that you would want, I'll do it. If nobody wants it, I won't do it. But as I say, somebody, you'd have to chip in a little bit. And if you don't want to chip in, then you don't have to have it. But for people who do want that, that's one thing that I'm thinking of doing. Also, for you audio people, I need a little help. I need a little help. I use Skype for most of these interviews. And my problem now is I got my buzz gone. I don't mean I was having a couple of beers on the show. But I got this buzzing sound gone. I had the level too high up on the mic going into the computer. I put that down, buzz is gone. But now, on probably 80% of my Skype calls, I'm getting a whooshing hiss sound only when I speak. As soon as I'm done speaking and the guest speaks, it's gone. And it doesn't happen on all the interviews, so I can't understand what could be causing this. So if you have any input into this, I put up a little audio sample of what I'm talking about at tomwoods.com/sound. If you have a spare minute and you have some knowledge in this area, could you take a look at this for me or listen to it for me? And in the comments there at tomwoods.com/sound, just let me know what you think this is and how I can get rid of it. I can do the interviews over the phone, but the sound quality on Skype is so good, I really want to try and make this work if I possibly can. So if anybody has any insight on that, I'd sure appreciate it. Don't forget, I got a bunch of events coming up in the very near future. I've got November 11th, Miami University in Ohio, and then I've got two events in Pennsylvania, November 18th and 19th. I got two events in Missouri on November 20th. So please check out the details on those events. I'll be putting up the logistical details as soon as I get them at tomwoods.com/events. And finally, remember, I'm giving away free copies of my book, Nullification, signed and personalized, for those people who join libertyclassroom.com in the coming days. I've got one box of nullifications that I'm going to be giving away, and then that is it. That's it. So if you want one of those, join libertyclassroom.com and drop me a line through our contact page saying, hey, you bum, I just joined. Here's my address. Where's my book? All right, that's it for today. Tomorrow, the skyscraper curse. What does it mean for the economy? Mark Thornton joins us tomorrow. This is going to be a juicy one. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening, everybody.
The Tom Woods Show.